In chapter 10, verse 12 of Deuteronomy, you'll notice that Moses signals a sudden shift in what he's saying. From chapter 4 all the way through the first 11 verses of chapter 10, he has been recounting the history of Israel's dealings with God. And then in verse 12, he says, "And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord, which I am commanding you today for your good." This is a turning point in Moses' speech. It marks a notable shift, as one commentator puts it, a shift from historical reminiscence to command. Or perhaps you might say it marks the moment when Moses shifts from a generalized discussion of what God has done for Israel and what Israel owes in return to a much more concrete explanation of what that entails. It's also very similar to the shift that you'll encounter when you read some of Paul's letters in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul often begins his letters by recounting what God has done, how God has delivered us from darkness into light, how God has brought us to new life, how God has redeemed and renewed and reconciled us through Jesus Christ. And then after that portion, he often shifts his attention to what we now ought to do in response to this grace. "I appeal to you, therefore," he says in Romans chapter 12, "to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God." Similarly, in Ephesians chapter 4, in a similar turning point of his letter, he writes, "I therefore, the prisoner in the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called." This shift in Deuteronomy follows a very similar pattern. Moses has been recounting what God has done for Israel, and now, he says, "And now, what does the Lord your God require of you?" And then he follows that with a series of five verbs outlining what the Lord requires of his people: to fear, to walk, to love, to serve, and to keep. Over the past several sessions, we've talked about the command to love, as well as the call to keep God's laws. In this session, I'd like to focus our attention on the first two of those verbs that Moses uses. What does it mean to fear the Lord? And what does it mean to walk in his ways? Let's begin with that first one. What is Moses asking of Israel when he tells them that they are to fear the Lord their God? Now, modern Christians, we're often very unsure what to make of this language. Very few of us, I think, would use the language of fear to describe our relationship to God. Nor would we really want to. We might talk about loving God or trusting in God or perhaps even obeying God. But fearing God? And yet, despite our discomfort with this language, it's everywhere in the Bible. The book of Proverbs says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And it doesn't just say that one time. This principle is repeated almost 20 different times in the book of Proverbs. That same principle is repeated in various ways in Job and Ecclesiastes, the other main wisdom literature books of the Old Testament. In fact, one modern scholar who studies these books goes so far as to say that while all three of these books differ from each other and nuance our understanding of wisdom in different ways, they strikingly will agree that the heart of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And it's not just in these wisdom books either. The American theologian C.I. Scofield, author of the famous Scofield Study Bible, he once described the fear of God as a phrase of Old Testament piety. Now, he was right that the fear of the Lord is central to Old Testament piety, but he was wrong to imply that this fear plays no role in New Testament faith. Jesus frequently told his disciples not to be afraid, and Jesus taught them that they could trust that God was their Father who loved them and would provide for them. And yet, at the same time, When talking to his disciples about the hostility that they would face from earthly rulers, Jesus could also say, "Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell." Likewise, the Apostle Paul told the Philippians to work out their salvation with fear and trembling. And in 2 Corinthians, he talks about how his own ministry is motivated by the fear of the Lord. And then later, Paul encourages the Corinthian Christians. He encourages them to obedience by saying, "Since we have these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from every defilement of body and spirit, bringing holiness to completion in the fear of God." In other words, the fear of the Lord is not just a principle of Old Testament piety. It is a crucial ingredient of Christian faith as well. But what does it actually mean to fear the Lord? Obviously, it doesn't mean just to be afraid of God, or to cower or shrink back from his presence. The Apostle James says that that's the attitude of devils. They believe, they know God is real, and that causes them to shudder with fear. But that's not what Moses is commending. So what then is Moses actually referring to? Some people will explain this sort of fear by saying that, you know, really it's just essentially the same thing as reverence. In fact, that's how some translations actually translate what Moses says here in Deuteronomy. Not that Israel ought to fear the Lord, but that they ought to revere him. But while reverence or awe, while they're certainly a part of the fear of God, that doesn't quite convey what Moses has in mind. As the Old Testament scholar Ellen Davis puts it, although reverence is indeed one aspect of a proper regard for God, that rendering misses the elemental character of the experience of encountering the real God. I think you can see what Davis has in mind when you pay attention to what Moses says to the people in the opening verses of chapter 11. "Consider today the discipline of the Lord your God, his greatness, his mighty hand and his outstretched arm, his signs and his deeds that he did in Egypt to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and to all his land, and what he did to the army of Egypt, and what he did to you in the wilderness, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, how the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up. For your eyes have seen every great work of the Lord that he did." What Moses wants the Israelites to remember, what he thinks will help them to develop a proper attitude of fear, is the overwhelming greatness and power and glory of the one with whom they are dealing. They must remember that their God is not only a God of kindness and goodness and love, who is the source of every good thing that they enjoy. They must also remember that he is a holy God of indescribable power, the one who brought down the great Egyptian Pharaoh to his knees and who reduced the powerful Egyptian army to nothing. And there's a good reason for that. There's a reason that Moses tells them to fear the Lord. And there's a reason that Proverbs says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Because, as the people of Israel will soon discover when they enter the Promised Land, because there are other nations out there with other armies and other gods, and when you see their prosperity, it's easy to feel vulnerable, and it's easy to feel impressed by the wealth of those around you and by their strength and their success. And over time, you might be tempted to trust in the kinds of things that they trust in because you have forgotten the power of Yahweh. You have stopped fearing the Lord. And if that was something that Israel was in danger of forgetting, seems to be even more something that we are in danger of forgetting today. Because like I said, while we may be drawn to talk about God's goodness and his love and his mercy, we rarely talk about the overwhelming greatness or power or holiness of the God whom we encounter in worship and prayer. I like how the writer Annie Dillard puts it when she says, "On the whole, I do not find Christians outside of the catacombs sufficiently sensible of conditions. Does anyone have the foggiest notion of what sort of power we so blithely invoke? Or, as I suspect, does no one believe a word of it? The churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. For the sleeping God may wake someday and take offense. Or the waking God may draw us to where we can never return. I think that's what Ellen Davis has in mind when she's talking about Israel's experience of encountering the real God. And I think it's similar to what Moses has in mind when he talks about fearing the Lord. Moses doesn't want the Israelites to cower and to just tremble and be afraid, but he does want them to remember the greatness and the power and the majesty of the God whose word they are listening to. So that's the fear of the Lord. But what about that other verb Moses uses in chapter 10, verse 12? What's he talking about when he instructs them to walk in the ways of the Lord? And this is a phrase that appears quite often in the Old Testament, especially in the book of Deuteronomy, but you can also see it in books like Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Kings, and some of the Psalms as well. And when it's used, it doesn't just refer to obeying God's laws or doing what he says. It's a metaphor that refers to doing the sorts of things that God does, acting in such a way that reflects God's own character and actions. In other words, walking the same path that God himself has walked. Or, to put it more simply, walking in the ways of God is another way of referring to the imitation of God. And you can see how Moses applies this principle in what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 10, just a couple verses after his instruction to walk in all God's ways. And notice first how he begins by describing the moral character of God. For the Lord your God, he says, is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Then right after that, notice how Moses applies that description of God's character to the Israelites and how they ought to live. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Moses' ethical command, love the foreigner in your land, it's a direct reflection of the way he describes God's own character. God cares for the fatherless and widow, and so you must therefore do the same. You might wonder, why does this matter? What difference does it make whether Israel's way of life is an imitation of their God? Well, I think it makes a great difference, and I'll mention two reasons that I think so. First, because it means that as Israel follows all the laws and instructions that God gives them, and as you'll see, as we continue to make our way through Deuteronomy, there are no shortage of laws and instructions. But it means that as Israel follows these, as they seek to follow them, that they're not just obeying a set of arbitrary rules. These laws, they're not just a bunch of demands made by some powerful deity who doesn't need to give any justification for them. I think sometimes we're tempted to think that way. Sometimes we're tempted to think that God treats us like a parent sometimes treats his young child, just giving a bunch of rules and commands, do this, don't do that. And when we ask why, that we're given no better response than that parent might say, because I said so. But God's not telling Israel to blindly follow a set of arbitrary rules. He's asking them to follow his example, to act the way he acts, to be holy, as he says in Leviticus, to be holy as he is holy. These laws, they're not arbitrary. They are grounded in God's own perfect nature, God's own moral character. And that leads me to the second reason that I think this metaphor about walking in God's ways is important. It's because it helps us to understand the relationship between the way that Israel lives, the way that we live, and the mission that we've been given. You might remember that earlier in Deuteronomy, in chapter 4, Moses tells Israel that if they keep God's commandments, then the result of their obedience will be that it's going to provoke awe and wonder among the other nations. And the other nations will say, "Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there that has a God so near it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today?" At first, that might sound like Moses is just saying that the Israelites should obey God's law so that other people will admire them. But that's not really what he says. He doesn't just say that Israel is going to be admired. He says that the nations will come to admire Israel's God, which is precisely the mission that God had intended for the people of Israel to fulfill when he made them his people. That's what God told them at Sinai, that he was making them a holy nation and a kingdom of priests, which means that their entire purpose as a people was to bear witness to the holiness and to the character of their God, so that the other nations might be all drawn to him. And as they now enter the land, Moses, he's reminding them of that purpose. Just as God had said to their forefather Abraham, he's saying to them that he is blessing them, but he's not merely blessing them for their own sake. He's blessing them so that they might be a means of blessing to all the nations. And the primary way that they will do that is by walking in his ways, by living in a way that reflects God's own justice and generosity and mercy and charity, so that all the people around them will see their way of life. They'll see how they conduct business, how their families are organized. They'll see how they deal with conflict, and they will be amazed at the grandeur of Israel's God. Of course, Jesus tells his own followers, the church, he tells us that we have the same purpose. "You are the light of the world," he says. "Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." Be imitators of God, Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, and walk in love as Christ loved us. Why? Because it is through you. Because it is through the church, as he says earlier in Ephesians, that the wisdom of God is being made known, being revealed to all the powers, to all the authorities in the present world. Because it is through your way of life that the nations are coming to know the true character of God. Keep these principles in mind as we continue our study of Deuteronomy. As we start to look at all the specific laws and rules and commandments, don't forget that these laws and these rules, they're not just polite suggestions. They are the words of the God who brought Pharaoh to his knees and worked wonders in Egypt. And don't forget that they're also not just arbitrary commands or wishes. They are a mirror, a reflection of God's own perfect moral character. And now, Israel, and now, church, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve him, and to keep his commands?